Have you noticed the older we talk about many, many years? And what a great thing it is to have friendships that have lasted many, many years. Jill and I are very, very blessed in this regard. I'm particularly interested in talking to a group of people who are willing to admit they are now seniors. A lot of people don't want to admit it. AARP says if you're 55, you're a senior. Get used to it. Get used to it. Jill and I were doing a conference for a group of seniors in Chicago. And just before Jill was to speak, the person who was introducing her gave some interesting statistics. And he said that now AARP are saying that if you're 50, you're a senior. And our eldest son had his 50th birthday. So I whispered to Jill, just as she was getting up to speak, what does it feel like to be the mother of a senior? And it was wonderful. Her mind went completely blank. So we had a very short message from her. But Jill was going to speak to a group of seniors on one occasion. And she said, I'm really looking forward to going to speak to this group. She said, I just love them. I just love them. And I said, Jill, them is us. So here we are. We are part of them. And it's a wonderful stage of life to be in. I want to talk to you about walking with God for the long haul. Walking with God for the long haul. Many years ago, our daughter Judy, when she was in college, said to me, Dad, there's a 10,000 meter race down at the lakefront in Milwaukee. Would you run it with me? I started all my kids off running years and years ago. For many years, I used to run with them. And now it was rather nice to have my daughter coming back from college saying, would you run with me? So I said, sure. Well, I'd forgotten that I had a men's breakfast that particular morning. So I had to go and do the men's breakfast, which is not good preparation for a 10,000 meter run. But I went and did it anyway. And so Judy and I arrived just before it was time for the race to start. 24,000 people were already in place for this event. We found our place, which was allotted to us. It was very carefully allotted. Right at the very front were a group of professional runners who had been paid a fee to run so that we could say that we'd run with these fellows. Immediately behind them were a group of Olympians. Behind them were many college athletes, and then behind them were many former college athletes. Then behind them were a lot of very, very serious joggers. And then behind them were some joggers. And this is a wonderful illustration. If you don't have much material, you can fill in a lot of time. But I do have some material, so I'll speed it up a little bit. Right at the back, I'm not going to tell you where we were, but right at the back, there were a group of very odd people. There was a group of five young men, and they had an old iron bedstead on wheels. And there was one person at each corner of the bed, and they were going to push while the fifth one lay on the bed until somebody got tired, and then they would get on the bed. So in actual fact, they were probably the most intelligent people in that particular race. There were a group of men dressed up in the outfits of the advertisement that was very popular at that time for Fruit of the Loom. Do you remember it? I don't mean do you remember Fruit of the Loom. We won't talk about that. But the advertisement, they were sort of dressed up like a bunch of grapes and a plum and a banana. These fellows were going to run 10,000 meters dressed up like that. There was one man on stilts, and being Milwaukee, it was no surprise, one man was dressed up as a giant beer bottle, and various other people. Well, the gun sounded, and off we all went. And all you could hear was the laughter and the cheers and the clapping right at the back. There's all these people who were doing all kinds of strange things, were coming past the crowds, and everybody was having a whale of a time. And if you'd asked them anything about that particular race at that time, those people would have got all the attention. Well, the noise settled down really quite quickly, and then everybody just got down to the serious business of running. You couldn't run very fast, there were just so many people there. And as time went on, you could hear people talking quietly as we were running, and then the talking eased off, and you could hear the flap, flap, flap of feet, and then a little later on, you could hear deep breathing. And then as we're getting towards the end of the 10,000 meters, you could hear people praying quietly. Oh, God, get me through this. I promise I'll never do it again. You know, that kind of a prayer. And then we got to the end of the race, and we were given immediately some water and a printout of where everybody finished in the race and a T-shirt that was far too small. First thing we did after having a drink of water was check on the printout, see where we'd finished in the overall thing. And then the second thing we did was look to see where the beer bottle finished. And then I wanted to see the Fruit of the Loom. Then I wanted to see the guys on the bed. And there's a very strange thing. They weren't there. And so I made inquiries. And the beer bottle was last seen leaning over a picket fence. One of the wheels came off the bed, and so they all quit. The gentleman dressed up as a bunch of grapes, his outfit split, and the others quit in sympathy. And the moral of the story, and I'm sorry to have given a moral to such a nice story, but the moral of the story is this. At the beginning of the race, they got all the attention. At the end of the race, there was no sign of them. And what's the moral of the story? The moral of the story is very simply this. It's how you finish that matters. It's how you finish that matters. A number of years ago, I read statistics about the fastest growing demographic in American society at the present time is seniors. And so I made inquiries of my staff at this church, how many seniors do we have? And one of the pastors came back with a printout immediately from our computers. She said, well, I found 1,000 in 5 minutes. I said, what precisely are we doing for them and with them? She said, very little. I said, all right, take some time out from what you're doing and check with other similar churches that we have relations with around the country. Find out what they're doing with the seniors and for the seniors. And we found the same thing. They weren't doing very much at all. And so I asked her, would you be willing to switch from the ministry that you've been doing for a long time and start a ministry for seniors? And she said, well, I've been in children's ministry for a long time, so why not switch to their seniors? I will not tell you the link that she made between the two. But then this is what she said. She says, Stuart, I would love to do it. I would love to devote the rest of my ministry to ministering with and for seniors. She said, they're the closest to eternity. They're the closest to eternity. She said, we are such a youth-oriented culture. Our churches are becoming such youth-oriented institutions that we're overlooking something very, very obvious and totally unacceptable. And that is our seniors. Not only is that the case in the churches? But what is the situation outside the churches? The simple fact of the matter is this. We have a world with a burgeoning population of people who are getting very, very close to eternity, and those people, in many, many instances, are very lonely people. So what does this all add up to? it all adds up to the necessity for those who call themselves followers of Jesus to have a vision. A vision to be an agent of God's working in the fastest growing demographic in American society at the present time, who are closest to eternity and in many instances are very lonely. And not only that, with the economic downturn, they're really worried about their finances. With the healthcare debate, they've no idea what's going to happen with the healthcare. Our seniors are the people who need to be in the forefront of our thinking. And Jill and I have decided at our age now that perhaps that when we're not traveling quite so much into the developing world, which we have done for many years, and which we continue to do at the present time, perhaps we're going to be pulling back from some of that and focusing more of our attention on seniors. I trust that we'll have a time of ministry that will encourage you if you're lonely, will challenge you if you're not sure what you should be doing with this stage of your life, and that you will go away enriched. And that's why I want to talk to you about walking with God for the long haul. Now, those of you who are familiar with your Bible at all probably recognize that this term walking with God was applied to a gentleman that we don't hear a lot about because we don't know a lot about him. His name was Enoch. We read about Enoch in the 5th chapter of Genesis. Very brief statement about him. It's one of those passages of scripture where a lot of begatting was going on. You know, everybody seemed to begat somebody, and otherwise they wouldn't have been begotten, I suppose. And it's in all this list of begats and begots and that sort of thing, which you wonder how you're going to beget out of it. But it talks about how old he was when his kids were born, how long they lived, etc., 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 which probably is not something we want to focus on particularly, but what we do want to focus on is this. It said, and Enoch walked with God. That's what he was famous for. Enoch walked with God. And in fact, they had such a close walk that he was out walking with God one day and he walked straight into eternity. I wonder how surprised he was. He said, oops. And he was not. But it's quite incorrect to say that he was not. He was more was than he ever was when he was. And this is what he says. He was not because God took him. He was not. God took him. Now, my dear sisters and brothers, seniors here today, simple fact of the matter is this, that we are busy living our lives now while our lives are happening. We're doing all kinds of different things. But the reality is this. One day they will say of you, she was not. She was not. Then what? Then what? And the best thing you can hope for is she was not because God took her. And why did he do that? For the simple reason that she was like Enoch. When she was down here on earth, she pleased God. She pleased God. So three things you know about Enoch. He walked with God, then he was not, and the reason he was not was that before he was not, when he was, he pleased God. Are you with me? Do you get my drift? I'm glad. I'm a little confused myself. All right. Well, now, how did he do it? Here's the question. How did this man walk with God for the long haul? And it was a long, long haul. You check it out, how long he walked with God. How did he do it? If you read the beginning of Genesis, you remember how it all started out. It was great. It all started out when God looked at what he'd made and he said, very good, very good. He was thrilled with it, absolutely thrilled with it. And then, of course, you know what happened. He gave tremendous responsibility to the pinnacle of his created order, that is humanity. And humanity blew it, and things went on the downgrade from then on. We're not given an awful lot of details, but the details we get are not at all pretty. You remember that the first boys born into the world, one was a murderer, and the other was a murderee. What a way to start. And things went from bad to worse, to worse, to worse, to worse, generation after generation after generation. Now, if you turn to the tiny little book of Jude in the New Testament, the cleanest page of your New Testament, it's immediately before the book of Revelation, you'll read something about Enoch there. It's very peculiar. It says that Enoch was the seventh from Adam. The seventh from Adam. What that means is that he was, according to the Jewish literature numerology, he was special, because the number seven in their literature is always a special number, a set apart number. And this is what it is saying. The seventh generation produced, incredibly, Enoch. And what's so surprising about that? What's so surprising about that is what every other generation was producing. Every other generation was producing an increasingly degenerating generation. Things were going from bad to worse, till in the end, God looked down and it grieved him in his heart. It grieved him in his heart that he had made man. And you remember he talked to Noah about it. But the lovely thing about it is this. When mankind in general was grieving the heart of God, Enoch was pleasing the heart of God. What a guy. What a man this was. Now, I'm not going to get into a diatribe about the days in which we live. I know the older we get, the better things were when we were younger. You see, we talk about the good old days, right? What did they talk about in the good old days? The good old days. What did they talk about? The good old days. Where did you finish up? The Garden of Eden. What happened then? They got kicked out. So the good old days weren't all that good. But we could talk about the days in which we live. And I believe there are so many things happening in our culture today that grieve the heart of God. And he's sorry, in many ways, he made us. But what he's looking for are some people who will walk with him and please him. What a bright and shining light Enoch was. How did he do it? I want to know. I want to be that kind of person. I'm sure you want to know. You want to be that kind of person. Well, if you look in the book of Hebrews, chapter 11, we have a little bit more information on Enoch. This is what it says. Verse 5. By faith, Enoch was taken from this life so that he did not experience death. He could not be found, because God had taken him away. For before he was taken, he was commended as one who pleased God. Now then, this is what it says. But without faith, it is impossible to please God, because anyone who comes to him must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who earnestly seek him. So here's we're getting a clue now. He has the capacity in a degenerate society to live a life that stands out beautifully. Where everything else grieves the heart of God, this man's life pleases the heart of God. But you can't please God unless you live a life of faith. So how did Enoch do it? And the answer is, he lived by faith. he lived by faith. You say, wow, you're building an awful lot on the little expression there. All right, go to the beginning of Hebrews chapter 11. Faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. This is what the ancients were commended for. Now, what does it say? He, before he was not, was commended as someone who pleased God. But why were they commended? All, not just Enoch, but all these other people in the honor roll in Hebrews 11. And the answer is, they did it by faith. And you will notice as you go through Hebrews 11 that it talks about all kinds of people who lived in all kinds of circumstances who had this one thing in common. They brought delight to the heart of God, and they all did it the same way. They lived by faith. That's how you do it. And that's what we're looking for in this world of ours today. Now, faith is a very, very common commodity. You realize that, don't you? This morning, for instance, this morning, your alarm went off. You half opened one bleary eye. You looked at it, and you believed it. You'd have given anything not to believe it was getting up time. You rolled out of bed. You used to spring out of bed, but now you just roll out of bed. You rolled out of bed, and you put your full weight on the floorboards and never checked one of them. You staggered to the bathroom, and you turned on the faucet, and water gushed out, and you said, oh, I don't believe it. I turned that on, water gushed out. No, you expected it. You peered in the mirror and you said, I don't believe it. Right? Okay. Then you ate your breakfast and never checked on anything. You got in your car, you started driving, you drove along the road, you had a green light in front of you. You barreled right on through the green light because you believed and you trusted and you expected that if you had a green, the person coming the other way had a red. Not only that, you believed and trusted and expected that that person driving the other way, whom you didn't know, you had no idea where they'd been, you have no idea about the car they were driving. You had no idea about their condition. She might even have been one of these women who was putting on her makeup and nursing her baby and talking in the cell phone while she's driving. And they call it multitasking. But Hey, folks, you trusted, you believed, you expected. And that's what faith is. Faith is believing that something is true. It is then committing yourself to that which you believe is true. And then it is expecting what you have committed yourself to deliver. That's faith. And I tell you something, you, for all your 50, 60, 70, 80 years, have been living by faith. But the big thing is this. Whilst we live by faith, for the very simple reason, that's how we're wired up. We are utterly dependent. We are totally intellectually limited. We are people who cannot survive solo. We are created for community, and that requires trust. And intellectual limitation requires the faith that will believe what we cannot understand. And it also means that as we experience various things, we learn to expect that which we trust to deliver. We do it all the time. But the critical issue is this. The most important thing about faith is not the volume of it, it's the object of it. We firmly believe in the covenant God gave to Noah. As long as the earth remains, what did he promise? Cold and heat, summer and winter, seed time and harvest will not cease. Come to Wisconsin. We have it all for you there. Very soon, you know what will happen. The colder weather will come, and our beautiful lakes will slowly freeze over, and the ice fishermen will come out of their homes. Ice fishermen are a very peculiar breed. They take a big auger, and they go out on the ice, and they will drill a big hole. And then they will put a line in there, and they will get a bucket, and they'll sit on their bucket, and they'll wait for a fish to commit suicide. And they will sit there for hour after hour after hour. Whenever I see them, I wonder what their wives look like. Why would they do that? But you know, it's tragic. It really is tragic. Because these people sometimes will be so anxious to get on the ice that with utter faith and dependence and trust, they step on thin ice and they drown by faith. Funnily enough, other people learn by that and they say, I'm not going near that ice. But in the end, the ice gets 3 feet thick. Sometimes it gets so thick there's no room for the fish and they die. But people are tentative. And you can put very little faith in very thick ice and be fine. You can put very big faith in very thin ice and be dead. So the key is we all live by faith in something. But what is your faith in? Well, we know, as far as Enoch was concerned, exactly what his faith was in. Now remember, he lived a life that pleased God. He did it by living by faith. We all live by faith, but it's the object of your faith that determines the validity of your faith. All right? What is the object of Enoch's faith? Verse 6. This is what it says. Without faith, it is impossible to please God, because anyone who comes to him must believe that he exists. Okay, that's where we start. That's where we start. Enoch believed that God existed. That is an article of faith. You either believe it or you don't. As far as empirical proof is concerned, you cannot prove empirically, mathematically, that God exists. You say, oh, that makes me nervous. No, don't get nervous. You cannot empirically, mathematically, or scientifically prove that he doesn't exist either. So you're locked in to an article of faith. In fact, there are two kinds of people in the world. You know, you said, yeah, men and women. I know that, but that's not what I'm talking about. The British and the rest. Yes, I know that as well. But that's what I'm talking about. There are two kinds of people in the world. Let me explain them to you. It's very simple. There are those who believe that God is, and there are those who believe that God isn't. Doesn't sound like much of a difference, does it? But that's the great divide. And from there, people go their separate ways and end up in totally different situations, live totally different lives, finish in a totally different eternity. So don't be nervous about all these increasingly aggressive atheists who are writing their books that are going to the top of the bestseller list. Don't get alarmed about all the people who are coming out with scientific proofs for this, that, and the other, because I'll promise you something, they will not come out for any scientific proofs of the non-existence of God or the existence of God. It is, in the end, a matter of faith. Let me tell you something. Let me tell you something called Pascal's Wager. You remember Pascal? He was the French philosopher who was going to write a book called Pensée. Pensée, that means thoughts. And he never did get around to writing the book, but when he died, they found all kinds of little pieces of paper with pensées written all over them, just scribbled down. And so somebody put them together. It's a classic now. Pascal said this, in effect. He said, if I believe in God and die and find I was wrong, I've lost nothing. If you believe that God isn't and you die and you are wrong, you've lost everything. So get smart. Get smart. That's Pascal's Wager. All kinds of people can see the logic of that. They can see the sheer common sense of that. Now, I know you can get into all kinds of argument. Well, if God is great, he's not good. If God is good, he is not great. All that kind of thing. Our objective is not to get into all those philosophical and apologetical arguments today. There is a place for them, and we should know them, and we should be able to answer them. But for our purposes right now, we're talking about somebody who lives in a degenerate society, who stands out from the crowd, and where the degenerate society is grieving the heart of God. This guy is pleasing him. And he does it by living by faith. And that starts with a faith presupposition that God is, that he favors over the faith presupposition that God isn't. All right, and then we go a step further. Notice what he says in verse 3. By faith, we understand that the universe was formed at God's command, so that what is seen was not made out of what was visible. By faith, we believe that the universe was formed at God's command. Now, here's another faith situation. Can we, on the basis of human observation, say specifically how the world was made? Can we do it on the basis of human observation? No. Can we replicate what happened at that time? No. If we do not have human observation and we cannot replicate what actually happened at that time, we cannot empirically prove how the worlds were made. So now we're stuck with another faith situation. Either there is a creative genius behind it, or it is a series of incredible accidents. Take your pick. Take your pick. Enoch was a man of faith. He exercises faith to believe that God is, and then he exercises faith to believe that the God who is was the creator of and upholder of all things, who by the word of his innate, intrinsic power brought into being things that did not exist. Wow, you said, that stretches my faith, all right? Stretch it a bit more and believe it's all an accident. So how are you doing so far? Are you a person of faith? Do you believe that God is? Do you believe that God created the universe? Now, if you do, you're part of it. So you therefore believe that God created you. Uh-oh. Now that's why a lot of people don't want to believe that God is, and they don't want to believe that God created the universe, because if they believe those two things, they can't wriggle out of the fact that God created them, and they don't want to be God's creation. They want to be self-made men who worship their own creator. But that wasn't a problem for Enoch. Now we go a step further. Read in verse 6. Without faith it is impossible to please God, because anyone who comes to him must believe that he is. Okay, so now we see that this God, who by faith he believes exists, and who by faith he now believes created the universe, including himself, for an intelligent purpose, now he believes that this God is not just a metaphysical force, not just a transcendent entity. He is not just either a creator who wound up the universe and lost interest. Now he discovers that he is a God to whom you can come. He is person. And he is approachable. And he is knowable. And this is what he believes by faith. And because he believes it by faith, because he has come cognitively to that awareness, emotively he is drawn to this knowledge. And he is saying, God, if you created me for a purpose, the most important thing that I can know in life is who I am. And the only way I'll know who I am is by knowing who you are. I come to you. So he believes that God is, he believes that God created, now he believes that God is person and is approachable. And not only that, he that comes to God must believe that he is and that he rewards those who diligently seek him. He is the God who blesses those who want his blessing, who saves those who want his salvation, who forgives those who want his forgiveness. With outstretched arms, as God himself, the invisible one, became visible, the intangible became tangible, the unknowable became knowable in Jesus, he stretched out his arms to the people and he said, come to me, all you who are weary and heavy laden, and I'll give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, and you will find rest to your souls. On another occasion, he said to Simon Peter, come, follow me, and I will make you. What a reward. What blessings he offers. And he not believed it. Not only that, Enoch believed, I don't know if he believed this in advance, but he sure believed it after it happened when he was not. He believed that this God to whom he had come, to whom he had related, with whom he had walked, one day would take him to be with himself. Now that's an article of faith again. You know why? Because nobody has died and come back and given us empirical evidence as to what's there. Now, I know we've had people who've gone through surgery and had strange experiences, and there are all kinds of arguments about that. Well, actually, I need to correct myself. There is one person who died and came back. And he said, and it's Jesus, of course, I'm talking about, he said, because I live, you will live also. Because I live, you will live also. Now, Enoch didn't know that. Enoch didn't know a lot of stuff you and I know. But what he did know, he believed with all his heart. And he believed that the God who is, who created all things, who is approachable and who blesses, is the one who takes people ultimately, finally, irrevocably and eternally to himself. And Jesus amplified this and he said, you know, when we talk about going to be with God, it's going to be in a new heaven and a new earth that God has created. And you and I are going to have new bodies. Oh, what a relief. No more hip replacements. No more sciatica. No more arthritis. No more blinding headaches. No more pills. We'll have a body, and you know what it'll be like? It'll be like the resurrection body of Jesus. Do you believe that? You know what else it says? In Jude, just before the book of Revelation, it says that Enoch, now actually we don't know what Enoch thought. There was a famous book or series of books that was circulating in the first century that purported to be written by Enoch. Well, they weren't written by Enoch, but that's who Jude is quoting. We won't get into all that now. That's for New Testament scholars to argue. But I mentioned it to you because you wouldn't know that I knew if I didn't mention it. Okay. But this is what it says. It says there that Jude was talking about the fact, according to Enoch, when God would come to bring about the final judgment. God would come to bring about the final judgment. And you either believe that or you don't. And Enoch believed it with all his heart. And he believed that God would separate the godly from the ungodly. Not the perfect from the imperfect. Everybody's imperfect. But there's some imperfect people who believe that God is, who believe that God created them, who believe that God is approachable, who believe that God blesses those who come to him, who believes that God takes to himself those he blesses. And they also believe that he is the one who is setting them apart as godly for himself, as opposed to the other people who don't want God. And they are ungodly. And God in the end will say to the ungodly, my dear ungodly people, whom I love deeply, whom I created for myself, you decided you didn't want anything to do with me, and it would be most ungentlemanly of me now to impose myself upon you for all eternity. So having decided you want nothing to do with me in time, I will give you the privilege of having nothing to do with me for all eternity. And that sounds like justice to me. Now then, put all that together. Put all that together and ask yourself two questions. Am I a person who lives on the basis of these faith presuppositions? And does it show in the person that I am? So much so that I actually put a smile on God's face. And the second question is this. All the people that I know in my bridge club or in my golf club, all these seniors who are getting closer and closer by the minute to eternity, do they know this? Do they know? And I think we can take those two thoughts away with us and ponder them and come back for the next exciting installment.